Today, I'm going to discuss the subject of God's wisdom. And we're going to take as our starting point a passage in the book of Proverbs. I was asking people before the session started if they had favorite Proverbs. And there were a couple here. Would you be willing to share yours?
Well, the first one indicates if you bring up a child in the way that he should go and wait and are steadfast, the child should turn out all right.
Okay, yeah. He won't depart. But I like how you said if you bring a child the way he should go and wait.
When he is old, he will not depart with it. Don't
right.
say we won't have
it's
problems
like
in between.
The teenagers.
Right. And then somebody over here had another good one, too. Yep, there's some very concrete and graphic ones. One that I remember is beauty in an ignorant woman is like a golden ring in the snout of a hog. So what you have in the book of Proverbs in the main section are some very pithy aphorisms, short sayings, sound bites, really, which are very popular in our time, which encapsulate some core human experience. But then, it's interesting, this is framed into a book about the wisdom of God and wisdom as a path of life, which is characterized by an attitude of respect, or they call it fear of the Lord. So knowing how to conduct your life in a proper manner. Knowing the right way. And the first nine chapters form an introduction to the book. And it's really interesting because in the body, all these short sayings, they're some of the oldest Hebrew literature that we have, whereas the introduction, which puts it in a more theological kind of framework, is probably from the 3rd or 4th century B.C., which is comparatively late for the literature in the Hebrew Bible. And in this introductory section, these first nine chapters, we have some of the highest kind of theological speculation about the nature of God's wisdom and where it's found in creation. It's a really interesting contrast between the sort of very earthy kinds of short sayings that we have in the rest of the book of Proverbs. I want to point out in passing that wisdom literature, as this is called, is very common in the ancient Near East. There's Egyptian wisdom literature that one can read from around 1000 BC or so. And it's mostly the words of a father, often a king or some other government official, to his son, telling him how to behave within the court. You know, don't speak out of turn. Show respect for the king, and so forth. Work hard, and then you'll succeed. And so there is a large body of literature in Egypt that you can look at that's similar. Now, in Proverbs, you also have, it's the words of a father, but it seems to be sort of a common father in most cases. There are a couple of places where it talks about the wisdom of the king. But it's kind of a popularization of the whole Egyptian form, I think. But what I'd like to look at today is the image of wisdom of God's wisdom as a woman. The first nine chapters of Proverbs state that there's two ways a person can go. You can follow the correct path, where you live a good life, or you can follow the path of folly and kind of go down. And these two paths are personified, one by wisdom, who's seen as a woman, and the other by folly, who's also seen as a woman. And both of them are out on the streets calling to everybody. If you look at Proverbs 1, 20 forward, we have wisdom out in the streets calling to everybody. Hey, everybody. And saying, you know, how long, in 22, oh simple ones, will you love being simple? And the people have rejected her, and so she'll reject them eventually. But she also, she continually calls to people to follow her. If you look at chapter 9, we see her building a house.
When you get into trouble, I will laugh at you.
Will somebody read 9, 1 through 6?
Wisdom has built her house and made 7 columns for it. She has had an animal killed for a feast, mixed spices in the wine, and set the table. She has set her servant girls to call out from the highest place in town. Come, ignorant people, and to the foolish man she says, come, eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave the company of ignorant people and live. Follow the way of knowledge.
Okay, thanks. What version was that?
Good News.
Good News Bible. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there, Wisdom's, she's calling out to everybody to come to a banquet and is providing food and drink here. So, if we had more time, we could look at some examples of folly. But instead, let's turn to the passage which is actually going to be at the center of our discussion now that we've seen that wisdom is personified as a woman calling to those, trying to instruct all people. And that is in Proverbs 22. Proverbs 8, 22 through 36. And once again, this is wisdom speaking, first person. And she describes, this is the most, this is the fullest description of wisdom's relationship to God and to all of creation. Would somebody please read that, 22 through 36.
This is the RSV. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limits so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him, like a master workman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the sons of men. And now, my sons, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction and be wise and do not neglect it. Happy is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who misses me injures himself. All who hate me love death.
Okay, thanks. So I want to list a few things here that we find here because as we look at passages which follow and chart the development of this image, we'll want to keep a few things in mind. Notice first you have in 22, the Lord created me at the beginning of his work. Does anybody's translation have something else besides created?
Possessed.
Okay. I'm going to put first creation here. But there is a problem in translation because the word is kanani, and it can be mean either to acquire or it can mean to create, but that's a very abstract way of putting it. It's actually to beget or to produce, to reproduce, to beget. I guess, you know, that's sort of the biblish way of talking about it. But fathered me. I mean, you know, it's not fathered, but so it can mean the Lord acquired me, the Lord begot me, and here they translate it in a more neutral way: created me.
This one says brought forth.
Brought forth. Okay, now that's closer to that image of giving rise to in a reproductive sense. Mm-hmm. Brought forth. Okay, so we have a first creation here, before the beginning of the earth, before any of the creation had happened. Okay, and then if you look in 27, he's there. She's there. Excuse me. She's there establishing the when God established the heavens, when he drew a circle on the face of the deep. These are all images of creation. So present at creation. Uh, Then we also have here that she, in 30, she was beside him at creation like a master workman. Now this is interesting. That's another problematic Hebrew word. First of all, we have first creation, or first acquisition, whatever that is. Then what is her nature? A master workman? This word, Oman?
Ours is architect.
Architect, okay. It can also be translated, what else do we have?
Confidant.
A confidant?
Craftsman.
Craftsman. This is great, different translations. What else?
In the footnotes, another reading is a little child.
A little child?
Oh, yeah.
Assistant.
Okay, so you can get the sense that people don't know how to translate this exactly. There's a lot of different directions you can go. And once again, it's related to the fact, we talked about this briefly before, that Hebrew is always based on three consonant roots. And the root of this is a guttural sound, M and N. And the other feature of Hebrew that makes translation difficult sometimes is that originally it was written with no vowels. So if you were to read something with no vowels, you could substitute a number of different vowels and get different senses. And so the different translations you have, they are based on different ways of putting in the vowels, which are, if you look at different translations, they've taken the word different ways. So it's very difficult to get back to the original sense. But anyway, she's present at creation, perhaps as the architect, the master plan, perhaps a workman, which implies more of an active presence. Also, as a little child, that stresses more the sort of the bringing forth, the reproductive kind of imagery as God's child. So it's complex. It's difficult to figure out exactly what's going on here, but. It says that daily she was his delight, always rejoicing before him, and in 31, rejoicing in his inhabited world, delighting in the sons of men, my translation says. So she seems to have a special relationship to the world of men, too. Men. I'm picking up on, you start reading a translation and you lose your inclusivity. Anyway, so she has a special relationship to human beings of some kind. And if when we read further on, she's speaking to humankind again, saying, you know, hear my instruction, don't neglect it. And in 35, he who finds me finds life and finds favor from the Lord. So she gives life to human beings. Interesting motif here, interesting depiction of God's wisdom.
I mean, you could really use any of these comments with regard to Jesus as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what did the New Testament writers do with this image as related to Jesus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your comment is can be taken as sort of a title for the rest of the discussion, actually, because what we're going to do is, first of all, I'm going to look at a description of an ancient Near Eastern parallel, an Egyptian parallel. Then we're going to turn to the literature, the intertestamental literature, of the Apocrypha, which was written between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and we're going to see the development of this image here of God's wisdom. And then we're going to turn to the New Testament and see how the New Testament authors took these images and applied them to Jesus as the Christ. So we'll be looking at that. Okay. Now, I do want, since we're trying to see things in multicultural perspective and trying to look at this image in its ancient Near Eastern context, I do want to read you a short section from a commentary, Harper's Bible Commentary, about a ancient Near Eastern parallel. I try really hard to find the primary sources and read those to you because I think that that's much more interesting. You know, there's a concrete text, but in this case I haven't been able to locate this material, so I'll read you something instead. I lost my marker in it, however. This is about the an Egyptian goddess named Mott. And if you remember, I mentioned that there was a lot of Egyptian wisdom literature, too, that seemed to be parallel to the works in Proverbs in some ways. Now here, I'm going to read a section that's called Woman Wisdom as Goddess. And it says, in acknowledging the international, especially Egyptian influence on the first nine chapters of Proverbs, this view, which views the woman wisdom as a goddess, sees woman wisdom as an adaptation of the goddess traditions of Israel's neighbors. In Egypt, the goddess Maat, and that's spelled M-A-A-T. It's not like the applesauce. M-A-A-T. In Egypt, the goddess Maat stood for justice, probity, and social and cosmic order. She was literally the undergirding of the throne of the pharaoh and provided the measure according to which the hearts of the dead were judged in the underworld. She is the first creation of the creator God in one Egyptian myth. And in various texts, she's conceived as both his daughter and the master plan by which he creates. Dum, da, dum, dum. Though never appearing as either a personal goddess or a particularly active character in the texts that survive from ancient Egypt, she is, nonetheless, an important figure in Egyptian wisdom instructions. Her protective amulets were worn by sages, as well as placed around the necks of the dead in hope of a good judgment. She's often depicted holding the Ankh, which is the symbol of life, in one hand, and a scepter, a symbol of power, in the other. Such symbols remind one of the image of woman wisdom in Proverbs 3:16, with long life in her right hand and honor and wealth in her left. And then it talks some about other more active personal gods that perhaps she's related to here. But I think the one example will suffice. So possibly this image of God's wisdom is based on the image of the Egyptian goddess Maat or some similar goddess. In any event, it shares some of the features here. But I think also, besides just signifying a random borrowing, I think that underlying this presentation of God's wisdom in Proverbs, there's a deeper theological question. And that question emerges in all the uses of this image. And I think that question is, how is God present in the world? It seems that although you have in Genesis and Exodus, you have God speaking directly to human beings, having theophanies, you know, showing up, revelations on Sinai, and so forth. In later times, people didn't have this kind of experience, and God becomes a very powerful God, but somehow distant or removed from the world. And there's the question arises, well, what is God's relationship, this relationship of this powerful God who's wholly other, something else outside of this created order? What's the relationship to the created world and also to human beings? Well, one answer is that God's wisdom is active in all of creation. God's wisdom, an attribute of God, part of God's personality, part of God's being, is active in creation and has a special relationship to human beings. Very concerned here. And we can see this developing very clearly in the apocryphal books. Does anybody have a Bible that has an Apocrypha in it? Is anybody Catholic and brought their own Bible along?
I have a separate edition in my room if you want me to get it for you.
Oh, that's okay. I have one here, but you don't. Uh-huh. I was just curious, just so I could call on somebody else to read, so I didn't have to. Okay, so if you are from the Roman Catholic tradition, then you are familiar with the Apocrypha. Can anybody read this green?
No.
Very well.
Yes, the black pen, of course.
There's a black pen, but it doesn't erase.
Yeah. No.
There's two problems. One you can't read, the other you can't get rid of, so I don't know. Anyway, the Apocrypha is a group of writings. The word itself means hidden, so it's like the hidden books, either hidden and set aside because they were holy, or I don't know. And actually, it's quite a big body. in this Bible, the Apocrypha is placed at the end. It's about this big here. And these are books which are present in the Latin Vulgate, but are not present in the Hebrew version of the Old Testament. Now, the history of that is that the Hebrew Bible, people found Hebrew difficult after a certain period of time, and you had Jews living in other places, for example, in Egypt, and they were beginning to speak Greek because this was during the Hellenistic period. And so around 250 BC, the Greeks of Alexandria translated the Bible from Hebrew into Greek to make it more accessible. Well, this is like our translations into English, so we can understand. So the people of Alexandria, Egypt, had a Greek Old Testament. Well, they would call it the Bible, a Greek Bible. But their attitude toward the Bible was a bit freer than our attitude, and also the attitude of the people that had the Hebrew version. And they composed additional books in Greek, and they also inserted passages into biblical books. So, for example, the book of Esther never mentions the name of God once. And although it's implied that God's acting behind history, the Greeks of Alexandria found that book too secular, apparently, because they composed prayers. So at pivotal moments, Esther, in the Greek version, will say a prayer to God, or Mordecai will say a prayer to God. And I guess this made it more acceptable, and they found it more pious. Yeah? Oh, sorry. Okay, so the Greek version then got fatter. They added to their library, whereas the Hebrew version did not. Now, the Christians were, after the first couple of generations, primarily Greek speakers, and were more familiar with the Greek version with its additions. And the Jewish people, after about, 100 AD or so, they decided they were going to go with the Hebrew version and not with the Greek stuff. Partly because the Christians used the Greek terminology to support Greek terminology and the intertestamental stuff that we're looking to support their ideas and claims about Christ, because the Greek philosophical language is much more amenable to the kind of Christological reflections than the Hebrew is. So we parted company linguistically, and the Christians have always, at least in the early centuries, used the expanded version, whereas the Jews have used the shorter version. Now, when the Reformation came, and actually before that Renaissance, people started studying the original languages again, and people started noticing, oh yeah, that's not in the Hebrew, that's not in the Hebrew, and so forth. And Luther, actually, in his translation into the German, he translated, he also translated the apocryphal books, but he pulled them out from the Old Testament, and he placed them in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and conceived that, he considered that they were important and edifying works, but not quite on the same level as the others. So now most Protestants don't even read the apocryphal or intertestamental literature, but it's really a fascinating treasury showing the development of ideas such as this idea of wisdom. The Hebrew word, I should have said this at the beginning, the Hebrew word for wisdom is chokmah. And now as we're coming into the Greek world of the intertestamental literature, the translation is going to be Sophia. These are both feminine words, Sophia. And although we're not going to look at it in this session, Sophia in the Gnostic world became a goddess in her own right and was seen as the goddess who created this world. She's sometimes seen as a fallen goddess who created a broken, evil world. She's sometimes seen more positively. But anyway, we won't have time today to look at the development of Sophia as a separate goddess, because we're going to be looking at this imagery that we have here and its development in the New Testament. But something to remember. And you can see how from this imagery it would be possible to have the development of a separate goddess. All right, so first of all, I'm going to look at, and I'll read to you since I guess I have the only copy here of the Apocrypha. I'm going to read to you something from a book called Ecclesiasticus or Ben Sirach or Sirach. There's a lot of different names that it's known by. And this is chapter 24 of Ben Sirach or Ecclesiasticus. This was written probably around 200 BC or so. And you'll hear many of the things that we've seen already here. In this section, wisdom speaking. It says, wisdom will praise herself and will glory in the midst of her people. In the assembly of the Most High, she will open her mouth, and in the presence of his host, she will glory. I came forth from the mouth of the Most High and covered the earth like a mist. Okay, so here, instead of being a creation, she comes forth from the mouth of God. If you remember in Genesis, God speaks and the world's created and is like a mist. In the second chapter of Genesis, a mist covers the whole earth at creation. So you do have that creation imagery. I dwelt in high places and my throne was in a pillar of cloud. Alone, I have made the circuit and the vault of heaven and have walked in the depths of the abyss. In the waves of the sea, in the whole earth, and in every people and nation, I have gotten a possession. Among all these things, I sought a resting place. I sought in whose territory I might lodge. Well, this is interesting because we have here, instead of present at creation, we have her saying, alone, I made the circuit and the vault of heaven. So now, not only is she present at creation, but she is the active agent of creation. And then she looks for a dwelling place. She's looking for some place to live. Then the creator of all things gave me a commandment, and the one who created me assigned a place for my tent. And he said, make your dwelling in Jacob, and in Israel receive your inheritance. From eternity, in the beginning, he created me. And for eternity, I shall not cease to exist. In the holy tabernacle, I ministered before him, and so I was established in Zion. In the beloved city, likewise, he gave me a resting place, and in Jerusalem was my dominion. So I took root in an honored people, in the portion of the Lord, who is their inheritance. So she's looking for a place to live, and she comes and she dwells in Jerusalem, in the temple. So she has a special resting place. Then there's a passage that describes how she flourishes, and there's a lot of horticultural imagery, and I'm going to pass that by. But I'm going to skip down to verse 19 here. It says, come to me, you who desire me, and eat your fill of my produce. For the remembrance of me is sweeter than honey, and my inheritance sweeter than honeycomb. Those who eat me will hunger for more, and those who drink me will thirst for more. Whoever obeys me will not be put to shame, and those who work with my help will not sin. So remember, I had us read that image of wisdom offering a banquet to those who would follow her. And that's not in this section in Proverbs 8:22 forward, but here we have that imagery of wisdom preparing a banquet. And speaking of images with Jesus in the New Testament, let me point that out right now because the passages we'll look at later don't have that. In John 4, for example, if you remember when he's speaking to the woman at the well, and he says, if you drink of my water, you will never thirst. And he also, in John, talks of himself as the bread.
Messianic banquet, too, would be
interesting. Mm-hmm, right, and a lot of the parables about preparing the banquet tie into this. Okay, and the punchline of Ben Sirach's description of wisdom here is, he makes a leap here. He says, all this, this whole image, all this is the book of the covenant of the Most High, the law which Moses commanded us, as an inheritance for the congregations of Jacob. Okay, so he, Ben Sirach, is looking at this image of God's wisdom as a description of how God is involved in the world, and initiating the line which continued throughout Judaism, he says, this is the Torah, this is the instruction This is the both the Old Testament and the traditions which developed later for living life in the way that God desires us to live. So he makes that equation. And if you look at Jewish interpretation of Proverbs 8:22 forward, that's always how they interpret it. So that's one direction of interpretation. And when we look at the New Testament application, we'll see the other, which is to apply this imagery to Christ. But before we do that, let's look at another intertestamental work, and that's the Wisdom of Solomon, and that's from around 100 B.C. or so. Now, as I read this, you'll notice a difference in the language, and you'll see how Greek this sounds, even if you don't know, what something Greek would sound like. You'll definitely notice the difference here. It sounds very philosophical. This is from 7. And Solomon, in this book, depicts Solomon talking about how he gained wisdom and so forth, because in tradition, you know, he's the wisest of all kings. And so he's talking about wisdom and the nature of wisdom. And he says, For in her there is a spirit that is intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, mobile, clear, unpolluted, distinct, invulnerable, loving the good, keen, irresistible, beneficent, humane, steadfast, sure, free from anxiety, all-powerful, overseeing all, and penetrating through all spirits that are intelligent and pure and most subtle. The Greeks love adjectives. And if you've read Paul, too, he has those long lists of the different virtues and the different, you know, vices and so forth, the gifts of the Spirit. They love it's that listing. For wisdom is more mobile than any motion. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things, for she is a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Interesting, a breath. You have that same image of coming from the mouth of God, a breath and an emanation, but it's a little more abstract here in the Greek idiom. But still coming from God. Therefore, nothing defiled gains entrance into her, for she is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God, and an image of his goodness. Though she is but one, she can do all things, and while remaining in herself, she renews all things. In every generation, she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. For God loves nothing so much as the man who lives with wisdom. For she is more beautiful than the sun and excels every constellation of the stars. Compared with the light, she is found to be superior, for it is succeeded by the night, but against wisdom, evil does not prevail. For she reaches mightily from one end of the earth to the other, and she orders all things well. So this sounds a little bit different. I mean, it's very much more an abstract statement, but we notice some of the same things that she comes from. She's a breath of the gods, so she comes from the mouth of God again, a pure emanation, and that she's in all creation. She renews all things. And then that special relationship to human beings, she, in every generation, she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. Okay. And it goes on, and Solomon talks about how he sought to take her as a bride. She was the consort of God, and so Solomon sought to wed her also. It's a strange kind of relationship, but I guess that's that sort of a mediating position between human beings and God. Let me write that down. She's a mediator. And I want to put down that banquet imagery, too. I don't know where to put it. Food imagery. Okay. Great. So now we've seen a couple of places where this image is developed in the intertestamental period. So let's turn to the New Testament here and look first. I think the logical place to look is the prologue to the Gospel of John. So if you look at John. And if somebody would read from 1 to 18. I'm just going to have somebody read 1 through 18, and then we as a group will point out similarities and differences and so forth, how this image was picked up and how John depicts Christ as somehow different too. Anybody? Go.
This is the Good News Bible.
Thanks.
Before the world was created, the Word already existed. He was with God, and He was the same as God. From the very beginning, the Word was with God. Through Him, God made all things. Not one thing in all creation was made without Him. The Word was the source of life, and this life brought light to mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never put it out. God sent His messenger, a man named John, who came to tell people about the light so that all should hear the message and believe. He himself was not the light. He came to tell about the light. This was the real light, the light that comes into the world and shines on all mankind. The Word was in the world, and though God made the world through Him, yet the world did not recognize Him. He came to His own country, but His own people did not receive Him. Some, however, did receive Him and believed in Him. So He gave them the right to become God's children. They did not become God's children by natural means, that is, by being born as the children of a human father. God Himself was their Father. The Word became a human being and, full of grace and truth, lived among us. We saw His glory, the glory which He received as the Father's only Son. John spoke about Him. He cried out, "This is the one I was talking about when I said, He comes after me, but He is greater than I am, because He existed before I was born. Out of the fullness of His grace, He has blessed us all, giving us one blessing after another. God gave the law through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only Son, who is the same as God and is at the Father's side. He has made Him known."
Okay, thanks. One point before we continue is Chokma in the Hebrew, Sophia in the Greek, wisdom. Now we have Logos in the Greek. And this is a masculine. Masculine noun. This is a feminine noun. Related terms. Logos meaning word, but also it's the underlying logic of things. It's the order which exists in all creation. It's related to our word logic, too. So it's a related term, but it's interesting. John chooses the masculine logos as he applies some of this imagery to Christ. Okay, so what similarities do you see? What kind of elements from this image of wisdom are applied by John to Christ? Now that you've seen, now that we've looked at Proverbs 8 and Ben Sirach and Wisdom of Solomon.
Verse 4 says He gives life.
Gives life, okay.
Present at creation.
Present at creation.
Mouth of God. Word of God.
The Word of God. So it has to do with that emanation, too. Mm-hmm. Using the Word of God.
A special relation. He gave power to become children of God.
God, uh-huh. So it has a special relation to human beings. Possibly we could say that's a kind of mediator figure also.
Well, verse 14, became flesh. That's the relationship to humans.
Mm-hmm.
Dwelt among us.
Mm-hmm. So that dwelling among, as in Ben Sirach, wisdom was looking for some place to live, some special place to live.
Full of grace and truth.
Full of grace and truth. Yeah, that reminds me of the Wisdom of Solomon passage. All those different adjectives that were used to describe wisdom. Okay, any differences
or additions? We should be law and grace. I mean, law of Moses, law came through Moses with grace and truth through the Word.
Mm-hmm. So it's a distinction from Ben Sirach's equation of wisdom with the law or the instruction. Mm-hmm. Different trajectory of interpretation here. Mm-hmm. Also, the whole, any other
differences? The world, mm-hmm. The world didn't know this, mm-hmm. you know, Jesus before Christ's arrival. Whereas mm-hmm. with the wisdom, there was more in relation with humans.
Mm-hmm.
That, if you
mm-hmm.
see what I'm saying.
Good point. The reason I'm looking like that is because I'm trying to remember. It's in either Baruch or Enoch. I can't remember. There's a passage where wisdom. I think it's in Baruch. Fourth Baruch, but where wisdom seeks a place among human beings, but nobody will accept her, and so she goes back up. But this is such a big topic that I had to just choose certain passages. But that's interesting. That's definitely different from the passages that we looked at. Mm-hmm.
First time today that there's been the image of light.
Mm-hmm.
Females and say Logos is a male figure. Now we have the analogy of light and darkness.
Mm-hmm. We had that appear also in Wisdom of Solomon, but good observation. Yeah, it's talking about wisdom as a pure light and a mirror of the image of God. Even it said it was even superior to light, because light after light darkness comes, but wisdom there is no darkness. So but good observation on the light imagery. Mm-hmm.
Question or observation, the wisdom coming through the law, resulting in the Jews wanting signs over against the Greeks as they seek wisdom, less concrete, more theoretical.
In the Greek sphere or here? Yeah, it does have that Greek, has some of that Greek flavor that we've seen in Wisdom of Solomon. Mm-hmm. Some of that terminology. Okay, yeah, one of the real differences I see is that there's the interspersion of this kind of mythic realm, you know, with things like, and John came, and so there's like the interjection of history into this story all of a sudden, and John came bearing witness to the truth, and then it talks about, and the Word was made incarnate and dwelt among us, you know, implying that the story that we're about to hear is about this incarnate Word. So there's a sort of a unique interspersion of history and this kind of imagery, which takes place more on the level of the divine, and although that does approach the human level too. Let's look at Paul's.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
When you're talking about wisdom, you're talking about wisdom as an image of who God is. Is that an extension from the female images that we looked at the other week?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm.
You know, or is the wisdom something coming from God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you just talking both, and I'm not making the jump, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's debatable, or you know, it's an issue.
I think it's both.
It's both. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's God, yes?
Yeah, because you said at the very beginning when you were using first creation,
mm-hmm.
part of the problem with translation was that one translation said that God possessed or acquired this
mm-hmm.
thing of wisdom
mm-hmm.
before creation, implying that God didn't even create it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is one of the great Christological debates too, is was Christ a separate creation? In that case, Christ would be inferior or secondary, or somehow, you know, a lesser God or intermediary, or were they co-eternal? Was it a part of the same God? I mean, this was one of the major disputes, and I'm sorry if I'm not clear, because I don't think that the church has ever been all that clear either. I think we've kind of waffled back and forth, and I certainly am not able to solve this big controversy. But yeah, a lot of inquests built on this very issue, and it's not clear. And do you see this as an image of God? Is this a feminine image of God, or is this an image of one of God's possessions or powers? Is this an image of God's self?
How do we reconcile that with in the Garden of Eden when he said, "Do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil," or the wisdom? There
mm-hmm.
he told him not to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting, because in the first centuries of Christianity, before Augustine, that was often interpreted, the tree of wisdom was interpreted as a positive thing. that's a whole other subject, this whole the whole story of wisdom.
Before and that, they didn't know anything was wrong. They didn't know anything bad.
Mm-hmm.
They only knew good.
Right. Well, and eating of the fruit and knowing the difference between good and evil is a prerequisite for the whole rest of the biblical story. I mean, we... We are required by God to know the difference between good and evil.
Yeah.
So in the early centuries, that wasn't seen necessarily as a totally negative story. It's interesting.
But see, so one of the jumps that John makes mm-hmm. is to take this wisdom from this material breath and make it a real concrete thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the jumps that John also makes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most radical differences, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And maybe the point of the Adam and Eve story wasn't the eating of the apple, but mm-hmm. the owning up to having eaten.
The owning up?
Yeah.
Maybe the point had to do with personal responsibility.
Mm. Interesting. I've never heard that interpretation, but that's a...
It's interesting to see what each of the man and women do when confronted by Yahweh.
Mm-hmm. They blame the other one. Don't take it.
Just like we still do. We can.
Now, if people are agreeable, let's look at Paul's, at a use of this imagery in Paul. This is in 1 Colossians 1, 15 through 19. We'll read that. First Colossians. And then we can continue this kind of discussion. I'm not really equipped to deal with the subtleties of these theological points because my area is not historical theology. But I know that this is the root of some of the biggest controversies about the nature of Christ in the church, this imagery and the applications of it in John and Colossians. This is 1 Colossians 1, 15 through 19. And some say this is a hymn that was already present in the Christian church and that Paul's using it. Or perhaps he composed it, I don't know. Anyone have that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a New Revised Standard Version. Paul, an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God, and Timothy, our brother, to the saints and faithful brothers and sisters in Christ and Colossae.
I'm sorry. There's some... 15?
Oh, I think you said
1
through
15. Oh. Sorry.
15
through
19.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Chapter,
verse 15.
He is the image of the invisible God, firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's do the same thing. People pick out phrases that they think are... coming out of this tradition.
Firstborn of all creation.
Firstborn of all creation. Mm-hmm.
He existed before God made anything at all.
Okay, he existed before God made anything at all. And I heard something up there.
All things created by him.
All things created by him. All right.
That puts it pretty clear that he was there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into that sort of the master plan, the worker
mm-hmm.
being the agent of creation.
Mm-hmm. Agent of creation. Mm-hmm.
Also, it says, in him all things hold together.
Things hold together.
Going to that, what you mentioned earlier, some wisdom God is who created the broken world.
Mm-hmm. Sophia? Yeah.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Also, that's in Wisdom of Solomon. It talks about Christ, wisdom pervading all things. And so forth. But yeah, holding all things together. Okay. That about it?
No, the firstborn among the dead goes back to the Egyptian analogies you mentioned earlier about how wisdom presided over the dead.
Hmm. So yeah, good observation. Good connection. I don't know how much I don't know how much historical connection there is, but it's a good analogy of like the types. Mm-hmm. Okay. For a couple of very briefly, one minute each. Why don't you look up this group here, Matthew 11, 18 through 19. Matthew 11, 18 through 19. This group right here, look up Matthew 23, 34 through 36. Matthew 23, 34 through 36. This group right here, look up Luke 11, 49. Okay, so the first group has Matthew 11, 18 through 19. The second group has Matthew 23, 34 through 36. And the last group has Luke 11,
49. Matthew 11,
18 through 19. Now, so Matthew 11, 18 through 19, we have Jesus being criticized as being a drunkard, having a lot of fun, kind of a carouser. So would somebody read that?
For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, yet wisdom is justified by her deeds.
Okay, yet wisdom is justified by your deeds. So there it seems Jesus is applying that term to himself. There's another translation, wisdom is justified by her children, some of you probably have, which is kind of interesting, brings in that whole imagery of wisdom talking to all the sons and so forth. Okay, so that's one example of the use of the term wisdom here in application of Jesus. All right, now, when we read this next section, you're not going to find anything applicable. Don't worry. But this is in Matthew, it's in the context of Jesus criticizing the Pharisees. And I want you to read this, and then we'll read this, and listen to the difference in terminology, because Luke uses the image, applies the term wisdom to Jesus. So this is an instance where we see the application of this imagery to Jesus, where Matthew didn't pick up on it. But okay, go right ahead. Somebody read Matthew first. Matthew, that's 23, 34 through 36.
In RSV it says, therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Barachah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all this will come upon this generation.
Okay, thanks. Now let's have Luke's version of this saying.
Therefore, also the wisdom of God said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute.
Okay, great. So the wisdom of God says, here's Jesus said this, here's the wisdom of God says this. So just a couple of examples within the Gospels of this use of the imagery. And so now we have 5 minutes. And we can raise any kind of issues, but I guess I'm curious what this whole concept of the wisdom of God means for us today. I mean, in this... In Jesus' time, they were thinking of it with this imagery in Proverbs in mind, and as with wisdom undergirding all of creation and so forth. Is this still a meaningful image for us? What is wisdom for us today? Or if somebody has another direction too that you'd like to take the conversation, any reactions to the material here?
One thing compared to the first reading is wisdom flies in the face of colloquial knowledge or of the perception of the people around him. He's hanging out with sinners and wicked people. What's the word I'm looking for? Conventional wisdom or the masses would say the right thing? He's going in the face of, well, not the masses, but of right, holy people. So this is a wisdom that stands on its head.
Now, how do you see that?
In the first passage says, who is this? He's hanging out with tax collectors and sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And his response is, well, wisdom is judged by the deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the one hand, the wisdom of the regular people is, this is not right. And then apparently, the wisdom of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
or the wisdom of God, defies the wisdom of human beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
That's what we read in our group.
It seems to me that a lot of contemporary society has divorced the whole concept of wisdom from Mm-hmm. Having wisdom tied up with God, especially in the person of Jesus Christ, that he is truth, and that to really find wisdom, we have to be in a relationship and have this biblical conception. I mean, certainly that's not what most contemporary society views wisdom. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The Bible says, search the scriptures.
Mm-hmm. And I think more wisdom is really not necessarily a separate thing from God, but an all-encompassing, big picture understanding of life. Whereas knowledge is what you would get nowadays from the knowledge and experience from the universities. Whereas wisdom is something that you have to do in order to gain. Mm-hmm.
You know, things happen, excuse me, sorry. Things happen to us personally and communally that devastate us and sort of disclose to us things that we hadn't seen before. And maybe wisdom has to do with the images that can freight the meaning of that for us, to help us understand. Like, for example, the riots in Los Angeles recently were devastating happenings to us nationally and for many people personally. And maybe the wisdom of God has to do with the images that help us grasp what this means for us in our time.
Okay. Well, the question I have was, why is this tradition of wisdom considered feminine? I mean, and perhaps you answered this already, you mentioned, but perhaps it's flown over my head. Why even these ancient goddess cults or such, why was it feminine?
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have a response to your own question? I'll answer it if you don't, but you answer it.
Well, I mean, there's all these prehistorical analyses and anthropological analyses of the goddess cults and this idea that women were good because they could do this amazing thing called childbirth, and there's this massive power to give birth, and perhaps that's I don't really have much of a response for that. Mm-hmm. It's just one idea. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it also because wisdom should be as desirable as a woman?
Mm, it's certainly presented in Proverbs as something very desirable for these young boys that are being educated. She's presented in sexual terms. You know, something very desirable to be sought after. I did want to get back to this issue, actually. It was one of my major points in the earlier session, and I kind of forgot it toward the end here, but okay, it could be borrowing from ancient Egyptian culture in the original, you know, version. But on the other hand, it could just be an autonomous, you know, invention or creation of this imagery. If you conceive of God as male and powerful, and you're stressing sort of the transcendence of God, that God's totally different from us, then there's this gap, you know, then there's the human beings here and what comes between. And I think because all of us have, or most of us, have that experience of a woman, a mother, as being, you know, a primary caretaker, as sort of the nurturing or intimate type of relationship, a partner in this very intimate type of relationship, perhaps that imagery of the feminine is what fills in that gap. And you also have that, you know, in the Catholic Church with the image of Mary, since you have all the male imagery for God, the Father, Son, and so forth. So Mary kind of fills in the gap and comes closer. You know, the feminine is something that's very close, very intimate. And what I wanted to suggest is that often people in discussion of inclusive language say, okay, fine, there's some inclusive imagery for God, the Father. You know, there's also God, the Mother, and, you know, so forth. And the Holy Spirit, okay, that's a feminine noun, you know, well, actually it's neuter in Greek, but it was a feminine noun in Hebrew and has feminine qualities and so forth, but Jesus was a male. You can't get around that, right? So that's a line that people draw. Historically, Jesus was a male, so, you know, what are you going to do with that? Well, I would say that the writers of the New Testament drew heavily on this image of wisdom, feminine wisdom, wisdom as a woman, and applied a lot of the attributes and the actions to Jesus when they considered him as Christ. And so I would say that there is a biblical precedent for talking about the second person of the Trinity, the Christ, as in feminine terms. And we have that in this image.
Okay.
So I thought that was one of my main points in the earlier session, but I kind of pooped out today. So I want to throw that out too. And time is up. Does anybody have any parting words that you must say?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that it goes in there, but it seems as though wisdom is rejected. So how do you tie that in with femininity?
Wisdom is rejected in First John.
If this feminine wisdom is incorporated in the person of Jesus, who is rejected
by the people of his own time or whatever, I guess maybe we're called to accept it. I don't know. Anyway, I'll close with that and.